Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new episode of Brahma Sports here on KPCRadio.com. I am your host, as always, Felipe Gamino. Before I begin with today's show, I want to congratulate Birmingham Reseda and Canoga Park on winning their respective championships this past weekend. The journey continues as all three schools will be competing in the state playoffs. Joining me in the studio is someone that coached also at the high school level and was the interim head coach in 2017 after Jason Sabalik, former coach, was fired. Here today is fitness center coordinator James Sims. How are you doing, coach?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So, as I mentioned in the intro, you coached at the high school level. What are your thoughts on three San Fernando Valley schools winning the top divisions?
Oh, I think that's outstanding. I coached high school for 20 years, and anytime you can have a area succeed in that way, that many schools, that says a lot about the high school coaches that are coaching in this area. It says a lot about the kids in this area, and that'll draw recruits to this area, which is a big thing. They want recruits to come here and get them. So I'm proud to be in the Valley and see that those teams are doing well like that.
Also to mention, the head coach for Birmingham played football here at Pierce in the early 90s, Jim Rose. Did you experience the same as a player or being a coach, like winning championships?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I played high school football in Akron, Ohio. And we were a constant in the playoffs when I was there. And the school that I went to prior to me transferring to that school, they had a reputation for going 0-4, not winning. And me and the two classes before me and, you know, up to my senior year were very successful. In fact, my senior year we played in the championship game. So it's a great experience as a high school student and making an all-star team and playing an all-star game and all the recruiting that went on and going on to play Division I college football. It's an exciting thing.
How were you introduced first to the sport?
It started, I had an older brother. My older brother was a football player, very tough. And back then, you know, I was in Ohio, it snowed. We would go out and play in the streets with the snow and play tackle football. And I remember at 6 years old, I was out there playing football and I broke my collarbone and I had to go to the hospital. And when I got back, I tried to go back out there and my mother threatened my life and told me to get in the house. But that was when I realized how much I loved the game, that even with a broken collarbone, I still wanted to be out there.
What accolades did you get in your playing career?
In high school, I was a three-year varsity player from 10th to 12th grade. I was a captain my junior and senior year. I made all city, all district, all NEO inland team. I also was the captain of the all-star team. Had some very large schools looking at me. I decided on the University of Toledo because they had just really cracked into Division I football as far as the competition they were playing. We had the Miami Hurricanes on our schedule with Michael Irving. Arizona State, you know, so we were picking up some good games. They had just won a championship bowl game. They had beat Randall Cunningham and UNLV in a bowl game. So it was close to home. It was close where my mom could come and see me play. It was 2 hours away from home. So that's close enough to get back to home if you need to, but it was far enough away from home to feel like you were away.
Yes. Yeah, so for many football players, their big goal is to go to a four-year or either play at the D1 level. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, some of the most prestigious universities are there. Was there anything you could have done differently?
Definitely. I would have taken a harder look at HBCUs at the time. I also would have taken a harder look, believe it or not, at lower division schools. We get so caught up in the fact that we want to go D1. Everybody wants to be D1. And as I got older and I became a coach, I started evaluating that. Why do you want to be D1? And the only reason for being D1 is television and hype. Because if you are a talented player and the skill set is there, you're going to go to that next level if that's your dream. But like I tell these players, if you don't go Division I and you feel you're a Division I player, when you're on another level, you should stand out. When I go see you play, if you're a junior college player and you believe you're a D1 player, when I go to that game, I should instantly know who you are because you should be better than everybody else out there. So that's a measuring stick to determine whether you should be at that level. But if you look at Walter Payton at Jackson State, you look at Jerry Rice, Mississippi Valley State, these were small schools, and they brought into the NFL players that became the best at their positions. So it doesn't have to be D1 for you to be successful.
So what was it like, since you mentioned you played at a university level, playing on Saturdays with all the media coverage? Did you feel that you were on cloud nine, or did you always keep your feet planted on the ground?
I've always been a low-key planted person. It was nothing big to me. I think the most exciting thing for me is I remember one time after a practice walking through the parking lot and having this little kid run up to me and ask me for my autograph. And the reason that was so big was not for the glamour on my side, but it showed me at that point the responsibility that I now had, that there were young kids looking up to me. So you always have to be on your best behavior and always doing the right things, because you do, whether you want to accept it or not, you're a role model. So it's a role that comes with that. And that, so that was the biggest moment for me at the Division I level, was the people asking you for your autograph and people running up to you and wanting to know who you are and know more about you. So it taught me all the responsibility that came with that.
So you played football, and then you transitioned into coaching. Mm-hmm. Was that transition easy for you, or did you feel that, I just need to be on that field making tackles, or?
It was a very easy transition for me, because since age six, my goal was to play football all my life for as long as I could play it. And then when I couldn't play it anymore, for whatever reason, when I couldn't play it anymore, I wanted to coach it the rest of my life. So it was such a natural transition. When I was in high school, we had little street teams, and our streets competed against other streets. And I coached our young street team. You know, we had six-year-olds that played against other six-year-old street teams. And so I started coaching as early as that. You know, at 14 and 15 years old, I was a coach. So it was something that I always felt was meant for me to do, to play that leadership role.
Speaking of your coaching career, you began coaching in Florida. What differences do you notice between football in Florida and football here in California?
Well, I guess to be fair to both places, I'm from Ohio, so I don't really have a bias per se of Florida, California. But if I sat back and just looked at both, I would say that Florida takes high school football a little bit more serious on all levels. Not here in California, if you're the modern day or, you know, Sierra Canyon, you know, their football is at a higher level and the attention it gets and the success. Where at Florida, it seems even your small 1B schools with a population of 100 students in the school, when it came to football, they take all the programs serious. They have a Friday night blast that's on high school on the news every Friday night. That's just like amazing. It's like a sideline thing where they go, the news goes to all the different sidelines and talk to people in the stands, and you talk to the players. And then we have media day, which every year before the season started, you would take your top three or four players and they would go down to the Jaguar Stadium. And all the radio stations would be there, the newspapers would be there, and they would have tables set up with your coach and the players, and you had this media day. So it was just so serious, you know. So that's one of the differences, how serious they take Florida football on every level, not just the top-tier teams. And the speed down there is just different. I mean, like I said, I've coached on both levels. Some of the schools I coached out of California, you might find one or two players that run a legitimate 4.3 or 4.4. In Florida, they came a dime a dozen. I don't know what it is down there, what's in the water, what happens, but there's a lot of speed. And you see that now with Ravens quarterback, you know, He's a Florida boy. He's from Boynton Beach. He played in Florida, and he just seems to be a little bit faster than everybody. And it's, I don't know what it is, but they breed speed in Florida.
So you were named interim head coach in 2017 here at Pierce College. Most of the players on that roster were from out of state, a couple from Florida, and a couple from Ohio. Did you feel that you could relate to them in a certain way?
Oh, it was an instant connection. You know, I guess everybody don't know the story. It's, I didn't run and volunteer for that position. I had coached for 20 years, and I had made a decision that I, at that point in my life, that I was done. I had completed my duty. I was done. Administration came and asked me, would I help them and take that position? And at first, my answer was no. And then a bunch of the players came to talk to me, and my answer became yes, because I'm that person that, you know, I'm not going to turn down, you know, these young men. So when I got there, we had like 30-something players on the roster from Florida. And I coached in Florida for 20 years. Well, no, I'm sorry, 13 of my years was in Florida. So I had a connection with them. I knew the high schools that they played for. I knew the competition that they played against. I knew if I seen a kid that played defensive back from Florida and I know what school he went to, I knew the type of coaching and training he received. So there was an instant connection there. And then we had a couple from Ohio. I was born and raised in Ohio. I played in Ohio. So I knew that connection. So it made it instantly a tight group for us. The kids respected me right away because I came from where they were. You know, it wasn't like they were all out here in California with all these coaches who don't know them, don't know anything about the school they came from. They now had somebody who could legitimately relate to everything that they've been through. So we got a bond right away, and that bond formed. And I mean, we were successful. We had, you talking about some barn burners. We had some great games from the day I took over until the day I left. It was really exciting.
So in your stint as interim, you take over on a Tuesday, Wednesday. You had a game on Saturday against Southwestern. You were in the booth to get a bird's eye view of everything. Then your first game in the stands was against Mount San Jacinto. The whole rest of the season was 8 games. What game sticks out to you the most while you were interim head coach?
Well, Mount San Jacinto was special because that was my first game on the sidelines. We were playing a ranked and undefeated Mount San Jacinto at that, and we beat them by 28. So that was special. That was like welcoming me to the job, and the kids showed me that they were willing to play for me. That really meant a lot to me. And then the last two games were very special. We were sitting at 3-5 because we lost some tough games on some tough calls, and we were at 3-5, and we could have quit. Everybody could have just packed up and just went through the motions. But you've seen a bunch of guys that were determined to even the record out. So we went out against Santa Barbara, and they shocked us. They went up 21-0 in the first quarter, and I just didn't know what was going on. And we came back and won that game in overtime. That was special. The excitement, all the coaches jumping up and down, the excitement with the players, I'll never forget that. And then, like I said, I'm a low-key guy. I'm not one of those coaches that yell. I believe when you talk to players, you talk to them eye to eye, keep your voice calm, and they'll listen to you and respect you. I'm not one of those coaches that yell and scream all the time. When I yell and scream, you know something serious is going on. So we were playing against Valley the last game, or Antelope Valley, last game, and they were up on us 17-0. We went into halftime, and I lost it. I was yelling, screaming, throwing Gatorades, and all the kids were in shock because they had never seen me like that. I was so much out of my element. And they took to it because they knew how much I cared. Because this was a guy who never screams, never yells. Last game of the season, and I showed them I cared. And I think that meant a lot to them. And we came back out and shut them out and won that game 22-0 in the second half. So those are the two games that stand out most. My nightmare game would be Valley. You know, we were down 7-6 on the 1-yard line to win the game with seconds left. And, you know, it was only my third game, and I was trying to listen to the coaches and be a team player. And they decided they wanted to kick a field goal when I wanted to go for it. and they blocked it. So that's one of those ones that'll haunt me the rest of my life. If I live to be 100 and anybody asks me this question, I'm going to always bring up that game.
You're mentioning about the victory bell. Valley has had it for the past couple of years.
Too long.
Mm-hmm. The game this season, it was a close one as well, but still Valley, who had forfeited the game before against Long Beach, came to John Shepherd Stadium and retained the victory bell mm-hmm. as well. And that was the first year under their coach, Lester Towns. Mm-hmm. After your stint in charge, you were there for an interim basis. You had the option, or they will evaluate whether you will stay on or they will go elsewhere. They decided to go for that second option. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts when you saw that they were going to go in a different path?
I was more upset for the players than myself, because remember, like I said, I didn't volunteer for this position. They came to me and asked me to do a favor. So at that point, I decided to do that favor for them, and I enjoyed it. We had a good time. We had a bunch of freshmen. We were all coming back. We were all looking forward to another year. And when we were denied that for what I consider political reasons, other people on the outside putting their hands in something when, you know, it should have been left up to those who make decisions in athletics, but that's a whole nother subject. At that point in time, it hurt me. It hurt all the players. And we had a mass exodus out of the school. And even at that point, I'm not that type of coach that, oh, because you didn't hire me, you know, start telling all the kids to leave. I was a shepherd for the school in a way that I was telling the players, stay here. You know, you came to Pierce not because of me, because you didn't even know I was going to be the coach. You came to Pierce for your career and for your education. And those two goals shouldn't change because I'm not the coach. So I tried to get them to stay, and they wasn't having it. They felt betrayed. Think about it. They lost their coach, Sablich, who they came out here with the understanding that was going to be their coach. They were hurt. And then I stepped in, and they accepted me, and then they lost me too. So they lost two people that they were close to in 1 year, and they didn't want to hear me telling them, oh, it's going to be okay. And it was like, we're not going to let this happen to us again. And you can't blame them for that. So we went from 65 kids that were working out in the winter down to, by the time they were trying to decide who was going to be the new coach, 15 players. So Coach Woods came in here with 15 players. And that's a shock to come take a college job. You have to be excited. I'm sure Coach Woods was excited. He comes in, he walks in to 15 players. That's terrible.
So as you were mentioning, they decide to name Carlos Woods as the head coach. He was on this radio show 2 years ago, to my understanding, or last year, I should say. Mm-hmm. So you were talking about Jason Sabolic. Just to share, I was at the field house. I had recently finished the interview with Jonathan Saavedra, who was the Brahma of the Week for that issue. I decided to go back down, process the photos, and the next thing you know, I get a message saying Sabolic and Hughes mm-hmm. were let go. Mm-hmm. So I tried to get a reaction from a couple of players, and they were like, hey, I'm not going to talk to you unless you promise our coach will be back. But then I'm like, hey, I'm just a sports editor. I'm not a freaking miracle person or something mm-hmm. like that. I don't make miracles. Mm-hmm. So there was a bunch of emotion. Good thing some of the players, as you mentioned, learned how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Unlike this time when Woods was placed under investigation for potential 3C2A bylaw violations, the players didn't learn how to react. They were throwing newspapers all over the place. They were threatening administration and several other people, mm-hmm. including the reporter. But I mean, what were your thoughts when you heard that story break out about Woods being placed on a leave or being under investigation?
Well, my immediate thought at the time was for the program, Pierce. Coaches get fired all the time, whether it's for legitimate reasons, illegitimate reasons, wrongdoing on the coach's part, wrongdoing on the administration. Coaches get fired all the time. If you're in this business and you've never been fired, either you're related to somebody or something's going wrong. Bobby Bowden once said, there's only two type of coaches. There's coaches that are fired and those that are going to be fired. So It happens, but it comes down to leadership and letting players understand that the program is bigger than the coaches. It's bigger than the players. And I always tell my players that if you ever lose me as a coach, this program is much bigger than you and I. Football was here years before I was born. It's going to be here years after I die. So you have to maintain the program. So when I first heard it, my first thoughts was poor Pierce, because Pierce has been through three coaches in 2 years' time frame, and we're just not, you know, doing well here and making good decisions for our sports programs.
So after Woods was placed on a temporary leave, they decide to name Anthony Harris as the interim head coach for the remainder of the season, who you know really well. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts on his hire, and how do you think he did for the remainder of the season?
I was shocked at first, and that's no knock on Coach Harris at all. Coach Harris is an outstanding man. I knew him as an athletic director in Pasadena, and he did an excellent job. I was just shocked because, once again, the decisions that we make to bring in an outsider that the kids were not, you know, they didn't have any knowledge of him, so the kids didn't feel comfortable with the move originally. Just shocked with decisions that are made. And we have to start considering, we always say students first, but it seems like when the decisions are made, it's administration first or it's school first. It's not about what's best for the students. And I just think if we don't stop this vicious cycle, we're going to keep having the same problems. You know, here we are once again without a coach. And if Coach Woods is not brought back, by the time they're able to post that job, bring in a coach, we'll be back in the same cycle. The new coach will start in March. That's when he'll get hired. His background check, he'll start in May, and then he'll have 3 months to put together a football program that's only going to have about 15 kids because everybody's leaving again. So they say that's the definition of insanity. If you keep making the same mistakes over and over again, expecting your results to change.
Also, one of the big stories this semester, without a doubt, has to be there not being an athletic director. I recently spoke today with Barbara Anderson, who's a member on the faculty hiring committee, and she told me that the president could decide, and I say could because that's an option on the table, could decide to appoint someone from the kinesiology department. I want to ask you, since you're also an AD, from your perspective, we are in December. The job was posted in July. Mm-hmm. 5 months have gone by, and there's still no one at the helm of at the athletics department. What do you think of all this?
Well, a lot of it, if you see what's went on here at Pierce over the past 3 years, with coaches being fired, Sablich gone, Nabil, who was a championship volleyball coach, gone. Our men's volleyball coach, Lance, won a championship, gone. You know, you keep seeing all these changes in the program, and they're not good. 2 years, the women's softball program has not been able to field a team. Now we're working on our second year that possibly women's basketball will not field a team. The necessity to change the baseball field, the football field is in bad shape. There has to be, at some point, somebody's going to have to take charge and show that they care about this athletic department, where to a point where somebody's going to be willing to take the job. And you got to stop just out there reaching out for people. You got to find people who care and people who want to do the job. Same thing with the athletic director job. On the AD job, you got to find an athletic director that knows how to do the job and care. You can't just go out and grab people just because. It's going to put you in the same situation.
You were mentioning about several other facilities not being in good condition. The baseball field, like other spots here on campus, don't have a scoreboard.
The women's soccer field.
The soccer field doesn't have a scoreboard. They had to play all their home games this year at the stadium because mm-hmm. of their field conditions. Yeah, but they did have enough to get a new LED scoreboard for football, which I kind of feel like they didn't need in the first place.
Exactly. So, and that's what I was saying. We got to get some people who care. You need some people in charge that care about athletics and want it to succeed. Not just verbally say you care, but show you care by action.
Just to ask you, what do you think the outcome will be?
I think we're going to be in a vicious circle. I don't even know if they'll keep football, because remember, we're still going to have to face possible sanctions for things after this. So we don't know whether they're going to allow us to have football. But if they do, and we do keep all our sports programs, we're going to be in a vicious cycle of failing until somebody steps up and is willing to stop and make changes and get people who care in position.
So, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we are out of time. I mean, we could go on for a whole hour, but I just wanted to take time, you know, and thank all of our listeners who tune into the show and listen throughout the whole semester. Follow at Roundup News and at Roundup Sports on Twitter for updates regarding the whole athletic director situation and, of course, regarding the coach investigation as well. If I don't have a show anytime soon, either next week or the week after, I just want to wish all of you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year 2020. Also, stay tuned for Wednesday because the Brahmas of the semester, the Fall 2019 MVPs, will be in print. Football, soccer, women's volleyball, and water polo will have a MVP for the semester, so stay tuned for that. This is Felipe Gamino with KPCRadio.com. Thank you all for listening. Have a great day.